to welcome you to the opening night of our Fall Live from the New York Public Library season, featuring tonight Orhan Pamuk. Later this month, come and enjoy Naomi Klein with Roger Hodge discussing disaster capitalism, Ken Burns with Robert Stone talking about the Second World War. In October, come and see James Geary, who will be juggling aphorisms while juggling at the same time. Don't ask. Later in October, Richard Pevea and Larissa Volokonsky will be talking about their new translation of Anna Karenina, a work dear to Orhan Pamuk. Also featured this season are Myra Kelman, Carol Phillips with Ian Baruma, Benjamin Kunkel, Newt Gingrich, George Soros, Peter Nadash, Umberto Eco, Sis Notebaum, and Nicholas Kristof. In order to keep up to date, join our email list if you have not so far, and you will get up-to-the-moment updates. Cards are on your chairs, leave them on your chair, or drop them in the basket on your way out, and you will be on my list. I have the pleasure of announcing a few new partnerships. These partners are Metro Newspaper. It's a media sponsor for the Fall Live series. In the morning, New York riders ride to work, read Metro, and are informed and inspired to seek out evening happenings and entertainment, such as those offered by Live from the New York Public Library. Debriefing of some of these evenings will be featured in Metro, keeping the conversation live, ongoing, and, as it were, on the move. So welcome, Metro. 192 Books is our new bookseller partner. 192 Books is located at 192 10th Avenue. Orhan Pamuk has graciously agreed to sign his latest book, a magnificent collection of essays and the pretext for our evening tonight entitled Other Colors, published by Knopf. Signed copies are available for purchase tonight. Welcome, 192 Books. Talking about Knopf, let me warmly acknowledge the presence of Sunny and Jita Mehta and congratulate Sunny Mehta on his 20 years anniversary at the helm of Knopf. Let me thank Sheila O'Shea, who handles all matters Pamuk at Knopf. Sheila is quite simply one of the best publicists in New York City. You enjoyed wine and cheese as you came in tonight. This comes to you care of Oriel. John Hunt, the president of Oriel, likes to quote Aristophanes, who said, "Quickly bring me a beaker of wine so that I may wet my mind and say something clever." And we have wine on stage, so that might help. Oriel is a merry band of winemakers all around the world who are creating tiny quantities of sensational wines using traditional techniques. John Hunt and his team will also help us capture some of the evenings through video and podcasts, keeping the conversation again ongoing. So welcome, Oriel. Thanks also to MTA Arts for Transit, Music Under New York. They are also on board. Thank you tonight to the cellist, Sean Grissom. Become a friend of the New York Public Library and receive a 33% discount off all future live tickets. Become a friend for as little as $40 a year. Better yet, please consider becoming an individual sponsor to support Live and the New York Public Library. Please join tonight, and staff members are ready here to answer questions, and I hope encourage you to join. Lastly, you will find a Q&A card, a question and answer card, on your seat. It's not really for the answer for you to give, but the question. If you would like to ask a question to Orhan Pamuk, please write it out clearly. By that I mean both intellectually and legibly. The audience and guests alike always appreciate concision. If you're seating on the left-hand side of the room, please pass them on the left, on the right, to the right. They will be collected in about 42 minutes from now. And now, ladies and gentlemen, after these many necessary announcements, it is my great pleasure and honor to bring to this stage Orhan Pamuk, not only Nobel Prize laureate for Literature in 2006, But also that same year, he received the highest honor bestowed by this very library as he became a New York Public Library Lion. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in as warmly as you can welcoming Orhan Pamuk. Yes, and turn off your cell phones. I hear a few nice chimes there.
Fasten your seatbelts and please turn off your cell phones.
Yes, and please wait until the plane comes to a full stop. Let's delve immediately into what really matters.
Yes. Not the cell phones, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, apart from the cell phones and the wine we have here, cheers, by the way. You say in Other Colors that the starting point of true literature is the man who shuts himself up in a room with his books. And this is a motif, it's nearly an organized web of obsessions that comes back and again in this book. And it reminded me of a moment in Blaise Pascal's Pensée, where he says that sometimes he has wondered where the cause of man's unhappiness. And he says that he knows one reason man is unhappy.
And what is that?
I always feel the same way. I mean, if someone is about to tell me one reason for mankind to be unhappy, we better listen. And he says the sole reason of man's unhappiness is that he is incapable of remaining alone in a room.
Well put, well done. I agree.
You do?
Mm-hmm. That, of course, that if you are incapable of being happy in a room, or you can't stay in a room, then you shouldn't lock yourself in a room.
Come again?
If you don't know what to do in a room, if you are, as Pascal puts it, cannot manage yourself in a room and end up being unhappy, you shouldn't lock yourself in a room. But then I really locked myself, especially in my early 20s, because I wanted to write, because I thought that I was inventing a second world which made me happy and which still makes me happy. But I understand what he means by that, especially in pre-modern societies or in all societies where the demand from the community, demand from the, say, what is community? The community is first our family, our friends, our school, our chummies, our buddies, friends we meet, the sometimes real, sometimes imaginary, groups that we think we belong to, or the groups that we need to give some meaning to our lives. I think modern literature, not literature in general, starts with a person's deliberate attempt to alienate, to put a distance from that community. Not that this person has a political or cultural or anthropological agenda in his mind or in her mind, but that this person just cannot do it all the time. Not that I'm also distancing myself entirely from the warm embrace of the community, so to speak, especially the family. But then I need to be alone in a room. But then they don't let you alone in the room, so that's why I locked the room.
Who doesn't let you?
Well, friends, well-meaning family members. Do you want some tea?
That's some tea. We can have some tea.
No, no, but in that situation.
You meant it that way. Yeah,
Orhan,
no, because
what
we
are
have
you doing?
Tea here. No, no.
Orhan, what are you doing there? Writing? Do you want some tea? That's what I meant. And that then, the well-meaning family members, friends, they And the whole, in fact, it's not the persons. The persons are always sweet and nice, but then what they carry around with themselves, the ideology, things that you don't want to believe, things that you don't want to carry around, things that you don't want to belong to. Flaubert knew this.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say Flaubert. I read in an interesting interview or article about you that Fernanda Eberstadt did the following. Your love, which we discussed a little bit earlier, interest perhaps you said, or maybe you didn't say anything, of Elias Canetti. He said, it's not that I don't care about going to parties or meeting girls.
Did I say that?
No, Canetti did.
Okay.
Why, does it feel like something you might have said?
Okay.
No. It's not that I don't care about going to parties or meeting girls. It's that the impact is too great. After one party, I can't work for 2 weeks.
I think I said this.
Maybe you did.
Yeah.
And why did she say Canetti? Okay, the more uneventful the life, the more material there is. Events kill the imagination. And now, Flaubert said the following. Don't take it from me.
Yeah, I know. That's Flaubert said. That's bad.
Flaubert said, the fewer erections, the better the writing.
I thought we were going to do a decent program.
What's not decent about erections? You know, Flaubert said about erections in his dictionary of
received
ideas. He said that erections, you should only speak about it when you speak about monuments.
I see. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, I don't care about Flaubert in these subjects. He was not good at that.
But so, I guess here we're talking about the notion of distraction, because in Other Colors, you mention both in the beginning of the book, in the middle of the book, and at the end of the book,
you mention
the notion that, in effect, you lock yourself up as
it
were for 10
hand,
hours.
It's not distraction in the sense that I'm inspired author, please leave me alone, what I'm thinking, important, so forth and so on. I'm not referring to that. And I don't think Flaubert was also referring to that. It was, joining a community, a group of friends, they may be your military school friends, your school friends, your friends here, your friends back in Turkey, has its costs. You have to agree, you have to backslap, you have to share, join, all nice words. I also want to do that. I do some of it, but some of it I cannot. But I accept it and go back to my room and write.
But literature, all
the societies are based on a strong respect on this idea of solidarity, that of joining, that of belonging. Then, and perhaps, since I'm the humble servant of the art of the novel, the art of the novel is structure, it's spiritual structure, its anthropological structures, implies that the person who writes this kind of stuff should have a physical or, in fact, more so spiritual distance from the community. I don't want to underline this. You opened the subject. But I also want to put a distance with the person who, I'm writing a book, please don't bother me. I'm not saying that. And in fact,
you actually talk about being a clerk, that in some way being a clerk is not something you see negatively, and you don't talk about the 10 hours as a moment to get inspiration. I'm always reminded of Leonard Cohen's line where he said that if he knew where inspiration came from, he would go there more often.
Yeah, of course. Would go.
Yeah, everybody would go to that room. But it's more that you, in effect, you're joining a community. It's only an invisible community in some way.
Just to clarify this clerk, I use this, and I refer to being a clerk in the sense that the tradition of being a literary, prestigious man on the pedestal is a poet in my part of the world, especially in Turkey and Ottoman Empire. The poets are great, are inspired, are visionary, are in fact special spirits of the god, and he whispers to them. But then I didn't feel like a poet, but realized that my nature is to write novels, be patient, wait at the table. But then there's also this metaphor used a lot in relation to the poets and novelists in Turkey, that poets are demonic, interesting, inspirational. You want to be friends with them. They're maybe drunk or crazy. But then novelists are boring. They sit at a table. You know, nothing happens to them. They are like clerks. And since Turkey is a bureaucratical country, clerk is not a very prestigious thing.
But there's a whole literary tradition also of the clerk as a figure that is heroic. If you think of a certain kind of literature that is close to you, I'm thinking particularly of Dostoevsky and more even so of Gogol, the whole notion of the overcoat, the man who is constantly writing and doesn't... I think Gogol says in the overcoat that he never knew, the clerk never knew if he was in the middle of the street or in the middle of a sentence.
Now, okay. Dostoevsky was a hard worker, but then he wrote at night till very late in early day. He had the habits of a clerk. All these writers of late 19th century were working like clerks because they were writing their novels for the feuilletons, for the literary sections of the newspapers, and it was an interesting period in whole Europe, Russia, in England, where all the writers were writing their novels first to be serialized. For that means that you have a very strong deadline and demand you have to finish, and then whether you're a clerk or not, you have to work till morning. So yes, he worked like a clerk, but then he never lost his demons. When the word clerk used against me in my part of the world or in Turkey, it is also it means uninspired, and I also accept that, or also implying that, okay, I accept being a clerk, but I will be a clerk, such a clerk that it will be, in the end, there will be some inspiration in it too.
The tradition of being a... Do you see yourself in that tradition of being a clerk in the sense that there's a manual activity in the act of writing?
Yes,
for
of
you?
Course.
Because you, as I understand it, you don't write with...
I handwrite.
You handwrite.
Because when I began writing, most popular device was the typewriter, and I was not good at that. And the typewriter was left behind, and the computer came, but I was already developed my habit so strongly that I decided that I cannot change. Today, I handwrite, then I give it to my special person in my company in Turkey, who is, by the way, is world fast writing champion. Then he sets it, and
really?
Everything is
really?
Okay. Yes.
So you have to...
This is not a coincidence. It is, in fact, that...
So you have to keep up with him.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's not, yeah. But then he's so slow because it's so hard to read my handwriting, so.
So you've made him a bit slower. But you talk about, in the early pages of Other Colors, you talk about an animal that's in you, the animal of graphomania. And that in a way...
Did I call that an animal?
You don't call it a gram, but it sounds good. Mm-hmm. You call it my graphomaniac, my greedy, almost implacable graphomaniac. And that it's only by filling up pages, as it were, by the act of writing that you satisfy yourself, that you
that
arrive...
I would say satisfy myself, but more so that I'm happy when I'm alone in a room thinking, not that I've developed an antagonistic or angry relationship with society, that I'm happy that I feel that the world is harmonious, meaningful, a pleasant place to be in if I'm writing peacefully in my room. And in fact, I want to represent the world as it is, as I see then. I want to represent the world when I'm happy, not when I'm angry, troubled. Because in fact, when I'm angry, troubled, or feel a bit depressive, or that the world is going wrong, and so I am also going wrong in it, then I cannot write well. In those moments, like many authors, I may be developing ideas that I would be in a peaceful time, write well about, but that, I think, it's a very pleasant feeling. In fact, that's why I write, to be alone in a room, to write a sentence, to think about a sentence, to be comfortable about a novel that I am continuously writing for 3 years. In fact, just like good readers, I think, oh, I hope this novel never ends. Maybe I will make it 700 pages. That kind of feeling, and continue to live like that. In this sense, there is no demon. There may be demons or other dark creatures in work here, but then the sensation, the pleasure of writing is so great and so comfortable that's why I write. I don't have a self-imposed political, social, moral mission. I write to be happy, and I always underline, perhaps because of my the community, the culture that I am born and raised and lived for 55 years, is that the demands of the community, demands of the nation, demands of the language, demands of this or that or political situation.
Of ideology.
Or, yeah, ideologies are behind, but the demands are never behind. We may say that this or that ideology is that, but the more strong thing is the demands of the community, that they are never behind. Maybe this is felt less in New York, more so in Istanbul, that I don't put an angry distance with the community, but then let me be alone in the room, and I don't want to also dramatize this. I dramatize this in the book, but everything is relative, because I'm coming from a culture where everyone should belong and celebrate the belonging, while I think the art of the novel and good literature is about being alone, or at least that's how I can manage.
You know, it's being alone and reading, in a sense, is that very act of being alone, but then connecting with the world in some way. When we read, we look at the page and then we look up. It reminds me, I've mentioned this in another context and in another interview, of Winnicott's famous line when he spoke about the relationship of babies and children to their mother. He said in a piece called The Role of Mothers for Society, he said that the goal is for the child to be alone in the presence of the mother. Mm-hmm. So that in some...
Let me consider this. Okay.
So that in some sense there is a connection. There's a connection, but at the same time there's an ability to be by yourself.
Yes, of course. Mother, father, also community. You need the presence of the authority looking over your shoulder, but then you're alone in that table. But then, again, I don't want to underline it. I want to go, yes, I sit at the table, but what about what I write?
But the authority of the father in your case was reversed.
It was reversed
in a very interesting way. One of the magnificent passages in this new collection of essays called Other Colors, which I really warmly invite you all to read as soon as you possibly can, is an essay called My Father's Suitcase, which was, if I understand it right, the speech you gave when you were awarded the Nobel Prize. And the story, I will say only a little bit and then let you comment a little bit more, the story of the suitcase is your father, towards perhaps the end of his life, coming to give you the suitcase and putting it in your room, in the room, in your library, which we'll get to the library in a minute, because that's too interesting a subject to, in this context of the library, to leave alone. And he leaves the suitcase there. There's a moment of discomfort between the two of you.
I also know what is in the suitcase. He had already prepared me for this.
You had already seen the suitcase on many
occasions. Not only I had seen it, but then formally he told me that, you know, I've been writing so many things, yes, Daddy, and so I want to give them to you. And then one day he brings them to me.
And Daddy wants you to look at what's in that suitcase, but only at a certain moment, which is he wants this to be a posthumous gesture on his part. In the suitcase is some of his writing. He had, early in his years, he had translated Paul Valéry. He considered himself somewhat literary, but in a way wasn't literary because he didn't live the life of the writer, which
means he was literary, but not as greedy and ambitious as I was.
Greedy, you said?
Yes, so that my father's spirit will not be, you know, hurt. that he enjoyed life and also cared about literature. I'm grateful to him. He had a great library. I used that library. He also taught me that great personages in life are not imams or religious people or soldiers as they are in Turkey, but may perhaps be. His heroes were Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, and he was talking about them all the time. One of them he saw in streets of Paris, and he also went to Paris and wrote and filled notebooks. But then it was not successful. It's hard to establish yourself as an author in Turkey anyway. He translated poems, he filled notebooks, some of them are inspirational, this or that. He put everything after I was, quote, successful as a writer, and gave them to me to consider perhaps there is something worth publishing about this after me, he
describe
said.
Describe a little bit what, because you do so in the book, and I could read it, but in a way, why not have you describe a little bit what feelings of premonition you had? You had two feelings, as I recall.
I had one feeling. I had two strong feelings, of course. One, just as you would all understand, a typical curiosity of a child. Oh, what did my father wrote in these notebooks? Anything secret? Anything sexy? Anything mischievous? Anything bad? Anything good? Anything interesting? Anything I don't know? And everything, as we all can imagine. And then this is one side. There is a strong urge to read them, and there is a strong urge or resistance not to read them. Why? That is how I elaborated on the idea of literature, because I also felt this very strongly. I wanted to read my father's notebooks. They may be very interesting, fragmentary. I had this notion of reading fragmentary, unpublished texts. They are even better than completed books. You know, look at Kafka, look at Walter Benjamin. They are famous for books that never finished. Maybe my father did the same. Let me have a look. I was very curious. But on the other hand, I was scared to death to read them. Why? Why? Because what if they are very good? First consideration. What if here is a good writer better than me? You know.
Something you didn't know up
to
then.
So that was the first thing. Not simplistic jealousy, but more so, if you understand that your father was a great writer, that you were living with a great writer for so many years, then I have not recognized my father. I have not met my father. I was living with this person, but I don't even know this person. It's because I'm a writer. To be a great writer is an important, is a good writer, even a good writer is such an important thing for me. So I was living with my father so many years, he was such a different and interesting person, but I was not aware of it. So I was afraid of that. But more so, if my father is a good writer, that is a real writer, then it means that he was living in a second world, just as I was doing in the last 25 years, that he was living in a second strange world that I didn't immediately, when I began thinking, it was almost a taboo. I didn't want to continue in this line. I don't want my father to be like me. I wanted my father to be a father, the person I knew up till then, not a person who may have a very interesting, very demonic, very strange, very different like mine, or as I perhaps thought of myself like that in vanity. And I didn't want my father to be like that. So that was when he put the suitcase full of notebooks filled with fragmentary writings, I had also this it was a taboo for me also not to read it. I didn't want to read it. But also, as I said, very natural. All of us can also understand that I also wanted to read it. So that's how in this lecture I elaborated on this theme of the way of literature. That suitcase was full of the way of literature. It's
the weight.
The weight of literature. It's heaviness.
Yes.
It's strength. It's all the connotations that it carries with itself, that of it can be damningly destroying. It can change your life. I wrote a book which starts with one day I read a book, it changed my whole life, so forth and so on. That is the strength and power of literature, which I was afraid to associate with my father. with.
You mentioned in passing a figure who I think is important to you and perhaps to both of us, is a figure of Walter Benjamin. And you write an essay which is, in my view, extremely humorous, somewhat perverse, and altogether delectable to talk about in this setting of a library. let's see if I'm right about it.
I'm also curious.
It has a title which may be significant immediately, and it's kind of an anti-Benjaminian essay, since Benjamin wrote the famous essay Unpacking My Library. You wrote a rejoinder.
Damaging my library.
Damaging, punishing your library.
Yeah, I did that.
Right? First paragraph, you talk about punishing your library. And the essay has a title which I think might inspire some people to do the same or not. How I Got Rid of Some of My Books. And you talk about punishing your library, and about since you were talking about the weight, about libraries are very weighty. It reminds me of when I was hired by the president of this library. He got the bill for my move, uh-huh. And I discovered then that I had 16,000 pounds of books. Uh-huh. And
are they all here?
No. The president of the library, getting the bill, called me up and said, you know, we're very happy you're coming, but, you know. Your books. And then he said to me, you know, we have some books here. And so you took it upon yourself, and you explain it as if it was something to do with earthquakes, but not really, to get rid systematically of 250 books of your library. Describe the reasoning, the motion, and also the reaction from some of the Turkish writers books you dispensed on.
First, this was not the first time I was doing it. When I was marrying, when I was going to a separate house from after at the age of 30, divorcing from my mommy and marrying someone else.
Divorcing from your mommy.
Then I got rid of some of my books as well. But this was my second attempt.
Attempt?
Yeah. I managed it.
Okay.
That there was, in 1998, I think, there was a major earthquake in Istanbul. And then during that earthquake, my library cracked and threatened me in such a horrible way that I have decided that if it was in the newspapers that there will be a major new, after this, a new major earthquake that will destroy Istanbul. Please beware. It was all in newspapers. I thought that for my safety, I should get rid of my books. But then I began doing that. But then, being a bit nasty person, then I also wrote which books I got rid of. And I also, not giving names, mentioned some authors that I don't like.
Yeah, you finish.
I forgot about that.
Well, no, actually, you don't mention names, but you do say, because I fear attachments as much as I fear love, I welcome any pretext to get rid of books. But in the past 10 years, I found a new excuse, excusing something that never occurred to me before. The authors whose books I bought in my youth and kept and sometimes even read, because they are our nation's writers, and even quite a few of the writers I read in the years that followed in recent years, they have colluded to assemble proof of how bad my own books are. In the beginning, I was happy that they took me so seriously, but now I am glad to have a pretext even better than an earthquake for clearing them out of my library. This is how my Turkish literature shelves are quickly losing works by half-witted, mediocre, moderately successful, bald, male.
Did I wrote all that?
Bald.
It's a translation mistake.
Oh, yeah. Traduttore. Bald, male, degenerate writers between the ages of 50 and 70. So I imagine some of the Turkish writers recognize themselves.
It's not all Turkish writers. There are so many bad authors in this world, but why it should be, you know, we just don't name them and skip the subject.
Right. No, I'm not asking you for names, but some of them recognize themselves, right?
Yeah. And some of them recognize themselves and answered back, but this happens all over the world.
Right. You say here in this very same essay, you say, all that having been said, the matter I wish to discuss here is not how much I love books, but how much I dislike them. The best and quickest way to tell this story is to remember how I got rid
Look,
of my books.
Look, perhaps this was also a reaction to the culture that that very few people read books, but a lot of people praise some imaginary people who reads books in my part of the world, in fact, all over the world. That there is a lot of lip service to reading books for readership, for how great books, and few people really care about books. And perhaps I expressed that anger. But
Is it the anger then of having a library as show, as
yes,
prestige?
Yes, it's also not having a library as show, that's inevitable. If you have a library, people come in. But then also I am upset by the people who, instead of talking about the contents of the books, talk about from which second-hand bookshop in Prague or Barcelona, they picked this strange book and before just found someone else, and it was such a great
book. But they're not interested in what happens between the covers.
They're not interested in... unfortunately, Borges gave lip service to that kind of act as well.
Well, you say that in your case, you say, fortunately for me, the imperative is not to own good books, but to write them.
Yes, of course.
A library can be an impediment, indeed, a weighty impediment, but it also can be, not having a library can be a source of great relief.
Well,
if you think of, particularly in your city of Istanbul, I think of someone who I think matters again to us quite greatly both, which is Eric Auerbach.
Yeah.
Eric Auerbach, I don't think you mention him in this book, but Eric Auerbach, it's famous. He probably wrote the best book of literary criticism ever written, called, maybe one of the best, called Mimesis. And he claims in the preface or the postface of Mimesis that the only reason he was able to write the book was because he was in Istanbul.
Yes.
And there was no library.
And Edward Said also refers to that in his preface to Orientalism. Auerbach came after Nazis were in power, and Istanbul was a liberated zone for the people who ran away from Nazis in late 30s and 40s. And he came to Istanbul, and he was a professor at University of Istanbul, and he wrote his great classic book, Mimesis, in Istanbul. And then at the introduction, he said, I'm writing this, perhaps I may be able to write this book because I don't have books, I'm writing from memory. I am very much concerned about my library. Now that I'm here, my library is back in Istanbul. It sometimes hurts me, but I wouldn't have such a great, or I would say big library with, number of books I'm referring here, as if there were good libraries in Istanbul, in my part of the world, and they would be as accessible as they are, say, in New York Public Library. But then a library is also, for me, my library is in ways, is my fatherland. Is where I think I belong to.
Your fatherland.
Yes. This is what I want to identify with. Now that I have some money, but then in my 20s, in my 30s, I didn't have money. When I came to New York in 1985, I would go to bookshops and would be amazed to see that some rich people are buying hardcovers. because I didn't have to buy, money to buy hardcovers at that time, but I was a obsessive compulsive book buyer. I would know all the secondhand bookshops where I can buy books, so forth and so on. But then our dedication to our books, our libraries, is one part of the whole thing, that I'm a bookish person, but then books are good for writing other books, but it all ends up there. There is also the human side to it. That libraries are good, books are so well, but then there is this dark side of us which negates all books, which are troubled by all books. And perhaps that is more interesting subject that, let me remind, I write that a part in Tolstoy's diaries where he says that Tolstoy was a very strong person who, in observing himself, introspection, that he wrote about this habit of his, that he's writing a novel, he's focused on writing his novel, he's in the middle of a sentence, that's what he remembers. Now, the next thing we read from his diary, he's reclining on his armchair or divan and reading a book. And he says he doesn't know how this happened. This I understand. This stayed with me because it's very important for me too, that I am a reader, but then I consider myself a good reader. But I grab a book, a random book, just like Tolstoy, and begin reading it. And books are, for me, a second life, that I should go there. Sometimes the world is intolerable. It's not sometimes, most of the time. Then you need to go to this space. It may be that I'm not writing well. It may be that I hear something bad. It may be that I have some depressive moment or this or that. Then I need books. Not necessarily, of course, a certain book, but it's all about the way the mind jumps around the world, the way the mind reads another text.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier on Borges, who, you know, famously said the universe that some other people call the library. And I'm wondering, this particular library has a significance for you.
Oh, I came here years ago, that I was amazed at this main public reading room. I was amazed. I did a bit of research for My Name is Red here, and there's also a rare book library here. In fact, there was an immense, big reproduction of a Persian classic, and then it was in the rare books or sumptuous books section, I forgot. It came with a...
Did you say sumptuous books?
Yeah. Whatever, extravagant.
I think we should rename it. Yeah. The sumptuous book room.
Yeah.
I think it sounds much better than rare books.
I was in the sumptuous book room, and they gave me this immense book with put on a wheeled table. I don't know.
So I talk about that because you said now that I am in New York, you are now living here. Living between New York and
Istanbul.
And Istanbul. You're teaching, as I understand it, at Columbia University, at least this fall. And you mentioned in some piece I read that when you were deciding whether to come to New York, you were wondering what would happen with your library. What I'd like you to talk a little bit about is your perception of New York at this moment. In your collection, Other Colors, you have a wonderful essay of New York in 1986, discovering New York through the gateway of Brooklyn. And now you're coming back 21 years later, as it were.
I didn't come here. I've been coming and going for years. And in fact, this year I came only 10 days ago. I'm so busy and hectic, I haven't been seeing New York at all. I'm in the taxis, driving around, teaching at Columbia, finishing a novel in my room.
And being here tonight.
Yeah, and being here tonight. Of course, I like New York very much. It's a second home to me, that I have enjoyed the world outside of Istanbul, in New York, the libraries, museums, the openness, the vastness, greatness, everyone complains about, I'm happy about. That I'm happy being here, a solitary person. I have very good memories of being sat here with my ex-wife, being alone. I have, one day I should write about this, that I spend, a very typical foreigner situation, I spend a non-Christian Thanksgiving Day here in 1986 alone with my wife, endless avenues, no one in the street, all the windows and shops were closed, and we thought this was a Kafkaesque world. But then all this, of course, I like New York because I have so many memories of this place.
What does New York offer you that Istanbul doesn't offer you?
A different culture, that makes me comfortable with the culture back there. and a different perspective, a different freedom, I would say, that I have here, perhaps the fact that I don't still belong here is that I don't feel responsible for everything here. You know, Dostoevsky has this very radical observation, which I agree that it words to the effect, I forgot, it words to the effect that we are all of us are responsible for everything. I don't feel responsible for
everything. It's a heavy burden to carry.
Yeah, it's perhaps because it's so big that I don't feel responsible for everything.
And Dostoevsky is very important to you. You have, particularly I was struck by your interpretation of Notes from Underground that I actually had never heard or never read or never thought of. I always thought that the Notes from Underground was a book about sheer and utter alienation, about somebody
who had liver disease. Yeah, that was how it was read in the 60s and 50s. And,
yeah, but then you say that you provide a real rereading, which has a lot to do with your notion of the center and the margin. You say the true subject of Notes from Underground is the jealousy, the anger, and I'd like you to concentrate on that word because it comes 50 times in Other Colors, the anger and pride of a man who cannot make himself into a European.
Well, first, we have to underline the fact that I wrote an article about a sort of a Turkish introduction to the Turkish new translation of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground. Then I had read carefully Frank's biography of Dostoevsky, which is great.
Joseph Frank, yeah.
Yeah, which is great. Then I, and since Dostoevsky is one of those authors that I tend to identify myself with, not that I'm a Dostoevsky writer, not that I want to imitate and continue in his line, because it's impossible to imitate him.
And because you don't want to carry the whole burden of the world on your shoulders.
Not only that, but because he had reached such depths with the art of the novel, with what he had done, that you cannot go fruitfully in that direction, and I don't want to, and I'm not that kind of person, but I have learned a lot from him. I am an admirer of Dostoevsky, but not a Dostoevskian writer. But anyway, in this Notes from Underground, Dostoevsky was waging a war against Chernyshevsky, obviously, compared to him, a shallow Occidentalist didactic writer who was writing about the wonders in West. Dostoevsky, the dilemma was this, that Dostoevsky was made from the stuff of the West. He went to military school but studied engineering as a soldier, and had learned all the ways of what they teach at West because of engineering. But then, after the in his midlife, he converted what was a typical, quote, I wouldn't say reactionary, but a conservative, was a Tsarist, was a Panislavist. And around that age, when he was developing these ideas, he picked up a fight with Chernyshevsky, because all the young generation of Russian writers and young Russians were admiring his positivist outlook, his admiration and enchantment with West, and Dostoevsky hated that. Dostoevsky not only hated Chernyshevsky and his admiration of the West, but he decided to contradict him, and in fact contradicted some of the important core ideas of Western civilization at that time, among which was the certain was that all human beings are rational and want to serve themselves and serve their society, and it's a good thing to serve oneself and one's society. And he wanted to negate that, and he said, he wrote words to the effect for the first time, in fact, in the life of humanity, that in fact human beings are not rational creatures. They would do things that would harm themselves so gravely, but then they would act with instincts they don't know about. He said these things before Freud, before all the
Freud
modern,
wrote a famous essay
all the modern developments in modern thought that in fact try to understand the dark side of human spirit. Dostoevsky went in that direction because in his youth he was a radical westernizer, an occidentalist. Then, so he identified with them. Then he rejected them and picked up a fight with them. But my point being that there was also a bit jealousy there, that he, as a Russian, he was of course aware of the fact that Russian culture, Russia as was considered by the West as barbarian, undeveloped, no civilization there. He was very upset about that, and he wanted to, he was angry to Occidentalists for looking down on his people. He always talked about Russian Orthodoxy, Russian people, but did not know much about them, in fact.
You say it in one moment in your book that I have always been off-center, and that being off-center is something that you have had to deal with. And in a way, it's connected to Dostoevsky.
Of course, that's...
You also say in the very beginning of the book that this book has a center, and that you are inviting the reader in some way to find what that center
yes.
is.
When I say off-center, of course, it's obvious. I'm a Turk. I'm coming from Istanbul. I'm heavily embedded in my culture. And then Turkish culture, Turkey, Turkish things, Turkish language has never been in the center of the world. And I carry that anger, that anger to the center, a sort of resentment. And I accept this. And I, once you accept this anger as it is, then you live comfortably with it. At least you can continue thinking about this. Of course, also there is this, the world center, the way it's used by Naipaul, but I use it on my way.
Say something about Naipaul, because he comes in, I think, at one and one only moment in the book.
Maybe but I'll tell something that I never told anyone. I was in Italy in May, and we were in the same hotel. Nobel Prize winners were doing some lectures or whatever. And then we met at the lobby. And then, this was a strange hotel. Then he left. I said, "Oh, pleased to meet you, Naipaul." And then there was this was a seven-starred hotel, and there were some butlers who were taking care of it. Then, as I was just leaving the hotel, the butler came to me and said, "Oh, Mr. Naipaul had just left with his wife, but he told me that he likes your books. He was very happy that he said nice things to me." But he did not, in a Naipaul way, said these things to me,
directly,
to my face, but told them to the butler. So I thought that this was an irony of life, that I wouldn't call myself post-colonial, but not two non-Western writers communicating through a butler. So when you open the subject of Naipaul, everyone immediately begins picking up his political incorrectness, and there are so many. There is an ocean of politically incorrect remarks. But then so did Dostoevsky did them. It's not the point. The point about writers is not where they fail, where they make silly remarks or politically incorrect remarks, but what they have achieved, what in very rare moment, in fact, that's very rare. Most of the authors, authors do not produce genius-like texts all the time.
They don't?
Sometimes they write something very extraordinary, and that's what counts, and that's what we have to pay attention to it. Not the silly thing any author says in an interview, here, there. The failings of an author is not interesting. What matters is what he, at the one brilliant moment, in a one extraordinary situation, developed and had taught to us. But then, unfortunately, now I have to complain a bit, the business of literary publication, literary business, is such that the genius or very interesting thing, one, the thing that an author establishes himself, addresses humanity, addresses readers, contributes to our lives, makes our lives more interesting, that is neglected. Then he says something in any silly in an interview.
Even these kinds of situations.
Or even in these kind of situations. So thank you for reminding me. I should shut up.
No, but I'm very much aware that I'm part of a process.
So okay,
opening up.
I should. I will. It's not whether you're on the left or you're on the left or right, whether you're in whatever political situation, your political position in your country. That's not important. What is important about Naipaul is that he is the first author in the world who seriously paid attention to the developments in what we today call post-colonial society. Well, after these bad imperialists left, and they were bad, a new generation of national important people took over in so many non-Western societies. Now, because of the guilt in West, the tendency was to praise these new developments without understanding what's happening to them. Naipaul, for the first time, paid more close attention to what the horrors that's happening there, and also, let's not forget them, he belonged to these places. He understood that man. He knew, he easily read through these people and understood what's going on, and A Bend in the River, Guerrillas, other novels, other essays, his second and third book on India, they're wonderful. And then he may be saying some other things that are not important or wrong that we should drop. We should drop the failings of the authors unless, if we feel an eternal enmity towards authors.
And in that case, I think we should just get rid of their books in our library.
Yes, yeah, we should. In that case...
In that case, we have a solution and you've offered it.
But I wonder, relentless.
Well, I wonder, you know, if we'll have a story from you called Naipaul's Butler or some such thing. But, you know, you were mentioning Naipaul and his portrayal of India in these two books. And I'd like to veer a little bit away from Other Colors to another book that, for those of you who have not read it, is a magnificent book of yours called Istanbul, Memories of a City. And you, in a way, you're writing about what is clear and dear to you, a place you have barely left. And Walter Benjamin once wrote that in observing a city, outsiders concentrate mostly on the exotic and picturesque, while the natives always see the place through layers of
memory. I refer to that in my Istanbul book.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was a self-conscious remark about the structure of that book. I wrote this book titled Istanbul with the idea that, I'll write a book about Istanbul like that. It's so easy.
You live there, you write there.
It's like, you know, writing about your room. But then when I begin to write it, then there was this, I felt that I am being pulled by two directions. That, well, you know, to be exotic, to be sugary, I didn't want to do that. Then, if I don't do that, then the city is an index of memories. All the things that I remembered, all the things that I experienced, all the things that troubled me or made me unhappy are associated with landscapes, streets, road signs, advertisements, things that we associate with a city. That, in the end, I realized that the city is an index of my memories. And then that I remembered this, that I came across this
Franz Hessel's
review of
The Return of the Flaneur.
They understood that that I am writing a book about a city, and I belong to that city. Inevitably, my book will be memories of that city, and then of course there will be the city. So I called it Istanbul, Memories
and
the City.
And the book, the genesis of the book is that, in fact, it was disparate articles that then, for the English edition...
First, I wanted to put together articles that I wrote about the book, but then when I realized that the demands that would be imposed on the book, I decided to left them aside.
And you rewrote the whole book,
some of the articles here in this book, edited them out, and then wrote a new book, an integral book about Istanbul.
You say in the preface to Other Colors, I have come to see the work of literature less as narrating the world than seeing the world with words. And in a way, you're making a difference between narrating the world on the one hand and painting it on the other hand.
Yes. Now, more and more as I get older, I'm regressing back to my childhood.
Very typical, in fact, that between the ages of 7 and 22, I wanted to be a painter. This prepared me for the solitary life that I am living now, in the sense that I'm locking myself or closing a door at least to write 5 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours, whatever, every day. Between the ages of 7 and 22, I seriously painted, and that was legitimate. My family praised me for he is going to be a painter, this one kind of attitude, which I was happy about. But at the age of 22, I suddenly stopped painting and began writing novels. Now, at the age of after the age of 50, I begin to develop a certain desire to return to that golden age, the time when I painted. Not that I'm going to paint, or maybe I can do
and
that.
You have a few. You have a few.
Yeah, I have a few things that's not the point. The point being is developing more, being a more visual writer. Developing a relationship between writing and painting. In fact, now I just came today, till 6 o'clock, I was in a class that I'm giving with another professor at Columbia University called, popular title being, Pictures and Words, Words and Images. We are giving a course surveying a survey of humanities, the relationship between pictures and text in history of humanity. And I'm more and more interested in the sense how visual literature is. There are authors like, say, again, back to Dostoevsky, who describe a scene totally dramatized way, and you read 20 pages of Dostoevsky and you don't know what's happening in this room, what are the objects, what is the color of the chair this guy is sitting, what color are the room, the walls, is there any other object in the room except beside the characters? This is obviously very Dostoevskian. It's very minimalist in the sense that there is no attention to objects that surround us, colors, the visual aspects of the person in drama. I care about that. That I think that the drama, and we have to find ways of representing, writing about human drama, human situations, and we have to associate our characters with the things and colors and objects, rugs or furniture that surround them. And this is what painting had. This is the richness of painting, and the whole French 19th century French literature. We cannot think of Balzac if we cannot think of Louvre. We cannot think of, say, Zola, if we cannot think of, we have to think of Zola along with the Impressionists.
Well, mentioning Balzac, I recall the line of Henry James, who said that in Balzac, objects are both our delight and our despair.
Balzac managed to write about a character along with the objects this character uses or surrounds himself, as if they were the extensions of his body.
Animate.
And also parts of the drama. Maupassant and Henry James followed this, exaggerated, the golden bowl, all the story turns around it. Or this object that someone leaves here and another person in 50 pages later picks up. But they manage to make the objects that surround us, the modern bourgeois interiors, part of that person's drama. Where the glorious emergence of modern bourgeois novels is, in fact, due to the lots of energy that first painters, with their painterly eye, paid to the objects, then writers, with their, I would say, again, painterly eye, paid respect to what had been accumulated as painting, as seeing, as ways of seeing, as seeing objects as the extensions of human drama. That is, I strongly believe, crucial part of the richness of art of the novel. And I want to self-consciously go into this area and develop.
You actually want to place yourself in that tradition.
Perhaps. Yeah. It's a way of putting it. Yes, there are writers who are very dramatical, like, of course, Shakespeare, we don't have to say that, or Dostoevsky, where there is minimal attention to what's the surrounding of the writer. And then authors like, say, Proust, Nabokov, and Tolstoy was the greatest, who are visual and who made what made their writing interesting is not only the drama or the framing of the story, but how they place the objects in relation to the characters.
You have about 5 more minutes to turn in your questions on the left and on the right. You mentioned the French tradition, and we haven't yet spoken about Stendhal, really, who figures importantly in your work. But there's one quotation you use at the beginning of Snow as an epigram, which I'd like to read to you, and I'd like you to comment on it.
Yeah, it's a way that's very popular.
And it's a way for you to comment on a lot of things, whatever you wish to say about this. And I might weave in to the Stendhal a Camus quotation, which I think is pretty good too. All this coming in a way from directly from your father, I think, who spoke to you a lot about Camus and Sartre. In Stendhal, famously in La Chartreuse de Parme, says, "Politics in a literary work are a pistol shot in the middle of a concert, a crude affair, though one impossible to ignore. We are about to speak of very ugly matters."
The last sentence most of the time is ignored. So in fact, I cared about the last sentence. "We are about to speak about ugly matters." This was the beginning of Snow, my novel, yes. Mm-hmm.
And the Camus line is, you comment on Lord, you say, "The perfect political story portrays politics not as something we have eagerly chosen for ourselves, but as an unhappy accident that we are obliged to accept."
So if you put them together, and this, an unhappy accident may happen to all authors, and he or she may find himself facing ugly matters.
And the relationship between politics and the novel?
Well, there is something called political novel. I think the greatest of Conrad wrote, Stendhal wrote, Dostoevsky wrote, the great political novels. I think I have experience in my early 20s that morality serving a cause destroys the beauty of literature. Most of the time, I have seen that good authors, well-meaning people, have destroyed their talents to serve a cause, anything. When I began writing in my early 20s, I decided that I will not be a political, and everyone was political anyway. They don't need me, I thought. What if one is not one author will not be political? But then, now 20 years later, 25 years later,
you have it's hard for you.
It's not hard for me, but I, in fact, the quote comes from there that I find myself in a political situation, not that I wanted it. Not that I had a self-imposed agenda of doing service to any cause, but then I found myself in a political situation and it was not good to live. That's all I can say about my situation. Novels in politics, not a great matter, in fact. I think that if you look at the whole corpus of, if am I using the word right, of novels that human beings wrote up to now, politics is not the most interesting subject, I think.
What
love.
Is?
Okay. Love, happiness, bourgeois life, meaning of life, education, goals in life, and disillusionment. These are the subjects. Politics in novels, the implication is that there is so much cheap morality in writing political fiction that it's hard to evade. I wrote a political novel and I did my best not to pass a moral judgment on any of my characters, or even if I pass a moral judgment, because I pass it because, you know, he is throwing away 250 books out of his library. That this guy needs a moral judgment, but not because he's saying politically incorrect things. The problem with political novel is that you have to, there is an high expectation from the reader that you pass a judgment on a character, while on the other hand, the strength of the art of the novel is that the writer identify with the characters in such great intensity that
no judgment, no, especially no moral judgment should be passed on a character. I think the art of the novel is based on a very humane, very human capacity that we have. In fact, human beings are unique among so many things in identifying with others. I can, in fact, in my mind's eye, try to understand what this person, who is not like me, whose skin or color or his richness or culture is not like me, or this or that way, is not like me, or in fact may have been even converted or invented to be an other, you know, a strange person, perverse person, different than us, you know, I don't want to know him, maybe carrying a different passport, so forth and so on, or maybe living in, you know, entirely different cultural, anthropological situation. But then there is that human being, and we have, human beings have, the capacity to identify with the problems of that person, to feel compassionate to that person, to understand that person. Not that I'm not saying that we are using this all the time. We cannot. We are also capable of killing 200,000 Iraqis and don't care about it anymore and just only pay attention to what George Bush said. We are also capable of doing this, and also we are capable of identifying with people who are not like others and with which we don't share any common interest as well. And art of the novel is based on this.
We may be listening to George Bush a little bit less now,
though. Yeah, of course. My point is being this, yeah. Let me end this, that the art of a novel works if there are different characters, if the writer manages totally or partly to identify with the characters. And that means putting oneself in others' shoes. And the problem with political novels is that once, in order to identify with someone else, you shouldn't pass too many harsh moral judgment on that person.
And this is where identity politics may get in the way. It reminds one of Flaubert's famous comment in that regard, Madame Bovary, c'est moi. Your next book now that you're working on, the subject of it is the subject that you held, you spoke about as very dear to you, which is the subject of love.
It's a subject of
and
love.
Love and Collecting, the Museum of Innocence is the title.
I'm finishing a book called Museum of Innocence. It's a long book, 550 pages chronicle of a upper-class Istanbul bourgeois obsession, infatuation with a twice-removed cousin who happens to be also a poor person, but a beautiful girl. But this is the main story, but then it's also a description of the upper class life in Istanbul and also the life of the poor. It's a fresco of life in Istanbul between 1975 and today.
The writing of happiness is interesting to you, and the happiness of writing, which we may get to. Say something about that, because usually the relationship between writing and, you know, particularly I think of Stendhal and the life of Henri Brulard. You remember that passage maybe where he's just come and listened to an opera and someone asks him how he liked that opera. And he says, I had the childishness to speak about my happiness.
Life is about happiness.
Really?
So, yes, inevitably. Then it is inevitable that literature should be about happiness. My point, perhaps, that I compare myself to other writers, other serious fiction writers that I care about, more and more outspokenly be concerned about this theme. Not only that my characters in my novel evaluate what they have achieved, what they are doing in life through the criteria of happiness, that is the goal of life, and that's such a, I wouldn't call ideology, such a strong idea that we all share, that it's natural that our lives should be organized in such a way that the main point is, of course, be happy. My question, first, I acknowledge this fact. I strongly believe in this
common belief that the meaning of life is to be happy. But then I also question it, that, but then what is happiness? Why do we want, why do we consider, how are we happy? What is happiness? Is it the satisfaction of our program that, we, you know, I'm going to marry this, a girl from this street which will be blonde, and I will make this money, and that will I will consider happiness? Yes, okay, if you satisfy these criteria, you're a happy person, congratulations. But then, is happiness this, or self-consciously, thoroughly being aware of this? Is happiness about the criteria? What is the criteria? Not that I'm saying that I'm challenging this very strongly, but I would love to, by the sides, by the edges, by the in the margins of my writing, to question this fact. In fact, not this huge, big idea, ideology, whatever you may call it. The aim in life is to be happy. That I accept. That is inevitable. And in fact, it's to say that my aim in life is not to be happy, and then if I'm not happy, then I'm happy. This is also sort of a paradox here as well. My point being that we there is a happiness is a satisfaction. The satisfaction
and the private one.
The satisfaction of unhappiness should be questioned in a mild manner, so as to see through it. I don't think you can understand it if you aggressively question it and say and challenge it. But in a nice, elegant way, if you slyly approach it and ask questions about happiness, then you may reach to another level, sir. That's what I thought.
Let's get to a few questions. Let's begin with one that's extremely short, and then we'll read one that is extremely long. Uh-huh. How was snow received in Turkey?
It was received both well and both in a good way and a troubled way. And it was received as, well, there's nothing new in this novel. We all know about this anyway. There was this kind of attitude. Then there was two parties described in snow. One is the seculars, the other is political Islamists. They were upset by some of the things that I wrote honestly about them. So there was a political reaction, and there was also we knew about this kind of reaction.
You lived in Turkey. Now you are here associated with one of our great universities. Would you share with us how your current environment supports your style of life? And how it distracts or undermines your style of life?
I'm happy teaching at Columbia University. Then it's not only teaching, I'm also learning from students. In order to teach, you have to read books that you have read so many years ago, again and again. This is the first job in my life. I have now a boss, president of the Columbia University. This is for the first time in my life after the age of 54. That's great. I'm happy. Columbia had always been so nice and generous to me when I came here 22 years ago with my ex-wife, that when I was looking for a place to write, then I coincidentally learned that they were teaching one of my first book here at Columbia in third grade elementary or third grade Turkish course. So they were reading my book and they were kind to me. And after 22 years, I'm back at Columbia. I'm very happy to be here.
Is being a Nobel laureate more of a joy or an onerous experience?
Both, of course. These are not contradictory things. You shouldn't, make a distinction between them. And I advise, I recommend to everyone this joy.
Well. Would you please finish your story about the Persian book in the sumptuous book room? You had just said it was rolled in the cart and...
Okay. Maybe I'll tell you something about this. In early 16th century, the Safavid ruler, the Persian ruler of the time, decided to make a real rich, sumptuous book. In that, he put together all the... prominent master painters of his time and invested lots of what we call today call money, and ask them to paint and illustrate Shahnameh, the Book of Kings, the classical epic of Persia. It took some 30 years to finish the book. And then finally, it was an extravagant book, and also an extraordinary book, because it has some, I forgot, 252 or 250 illustrations, while a typical medieval Islamic manuscript book, which was illustrated, would have 10 or 20 illustrations. This one was really such an ambitious thing that finally the book was made. But then Ottomans in early 16th century invaded Persia and took the book back to Topkapı Library, where it stayed for another 400 years. Then from Ottoman Topkapı Library, it was stolen, disappeared, and surfaced again in some Western library. Then it was in the last years of Shah of Iran, in order to represent himself and show the world the richness of Persian culture, and he was right about this, he organized a reproduction of that book. That was the book, the reproduction book that came to me when I was writing My Name is Red. But then the reproduction book was published finally. Another 30 years took to write that book. The Shah of Iran was already kicked out of power. Irony of ironies. So that book didn't make anyone happy. But then I used it and wrote My Name is Red.
Two more questions. As to your craft, the endings of your books are so perfect. Do you write your endings first and then start at the beginning?
Oh.
And how much do you write, reorganize, and revise?
Thank you for this question. Most I always rewrite other chapters. And I plan ahead. I'm compared to other writers. I plan my books ahead, so that I don't have writer's block. When I have a writer's block, I skip to another chapter, so forth and so on. When I'm finishing a novel, I go back and write probably 80-70% of the previous chapters again, but I never write the ending. It's a sort of a climax. I wait the ending and only write it at the last moment once. If I fail there, I fail there. And so that's a good recommendation. I should never rewrite.
And this is true also about your book on Istanbul.
That yeah, it's true. Of
because the last line is very significant.
It's a joy to think about the various endings of a book. It's such a great joy. You write the book, you always think, what will happen to this character, what will happen to that character, and it's you're troubled about the middle section of the book, the beginnings of the book, towards the ending of the book, you're troubled. But then, even in the worst times, it's such a great joy to think that, oh, the ending will be like this. Oh, great, okay, I'll write it here. So, but then, I never write an ending before, and I only write it once. I think the most happiest ending was that when I wrote the ending of My Name is Red, that that in Turkey, if you finish a book, in 10 days I can go to the printer and publish it. That's how I do it. Which is good because I can never finish books.
And you have that man typing real fast.
Exactly. Everyone was ready. The book was going to be printed, lots of copies by Turkish standard. Great, I was happy, everyone was happy, but still I couldn't finish the book. So I needed to write some 3 pages, but I couldn't write them. The last 3 pages of My Name is Red, but everyone is waiting. I can't finish and conclude the book. I know what I'm going to write, but I can't. Finally, I said to my wife and to my daughter, let's go to this hotel close to Istanbul. So in 2 days, I finished that. So we go there. And then they're so sweet, and they were hanging around, and I'm writing, And finally, the last half page, and I said, get out, go to the garden, And I wrote the last lines with a burst of creativity and energy, with such intense happiness. And I finished, went out of the room. It was a summer resort, so no one was there. It was all empty, a bit creepy, like Jack Nicholson's. So not that bad. So finally, the novel was finished. So I was so happy. I opened the door and I shouted, "Come here! It's finished!" And it was there was an echo because no one was around, and they all came and they we all embraced, kissed. The novel is finished. That was the happiness of it.
The next question I will skip. I would like you to read a page which is very much in that spirit.
It's not in this spirit, in fact. For me, finishing a book, writing a book, is a strong sense of happiness. But then we write because we are not happy. So it's all about, writing is about being happy and not being happy.
And if you were completely happy, maybe you wouldn't continue to write.
Yes, definitely. If I were to be completely happy, I would never have written anything. But the irony of it that I write my best pages when I'm happy. I develop my best ideas when I'm not happy. But then I have to be very happy to write. But then everyone is asking all the authors of the world, why do you write? And here is my answer. As you know, the question we writers are asked most often, the favorite question is, why do you write? Here is my answer. I write because I have an innate need to write. I write because I can't do normal work like other people. I write because I want to read books like the ones I write. I write because I'm angry at all of you. Angry at everyone. I write because I love sitting in a room all day writing. I write because I can only partake in real life by changing it. I write because I want others, all of us, the whole world, to know what sort of life we lived and continue to live in Istanbul, in Turkey. I write because I love the smell of paper, pen and ink. I write because I believe in literature, in the art of the novel, more than I believe in anything else. I write because it's a habit, a passion. I write because I'm afraid of being forgotten. I write because I like the glory and interest that writing brings. I write to be alone. Perhaps I write because I hope to understand why I'm so very, very angry at all of you, so very, very angry. Angry at everyone. I write because I like to be read. I write because once I have begun a novel, an essay, a page, I want to finish it. I write because everyone expects me to write. I write because I have a childish belief in the immortality of libraries and in the way my book sits on the shelf. I write because it's exciting to turn all of life's beauties and riches into words. I write not to tell a story, but to compose a story. I write because I wish to escape from the foreboding that there is a place I must go, but just as in a dream, I can't quite get there. I write because I have never managed to be happy. I write to be happy.
Thank you very much.
So where do we go now? This direction?
Thank you.